Ever wonder why we just can't seem to get enough of vampires and zombies? I mean, if you read popular fiction or watch blockbuster movies, I bet you've fallen under the spell of at least a few vampires or zombies. Lestat? Edward Cullen? Or maybe one of Sookie Stackhouse's many fanged boyfriends? What's behind their perennial appeal? Steve Paulson has some ideas. Steve?
Well, Anne, I just finished reading a fascinating book called Gothica by the cultural historian Victoria Nelson. And she has a really interesting take on why we're so obsessed with vampires and ghosts and all these other monsters. She says these stories, which come out of the long tradition of Gothic literature, are now the place in our culture where our ideas about the transcendent get played out.
She thinks we're reading vampire stories because we're really hungry for religion?
Well, she kind of does. And there's one way to think about this. If you look at polling data, you'll see that more and more people are leaving the churches and religious institutions that they grew up in, and yet they still often have a kind of spiritual hunger, a longing for the supernatural. So the question is, where do you go to find it if you feel alienated by organized religion? Well, Victoria Nelson thinks that we're going to pop culture instead, to movies, pulp fiction, even graphic novels. And she says this was true for her as well.
I think it started for me as a kid. I loved reading ghost stories, and I felt this deep attraction to the supernatural. And the only way you could get a supernatural fix was not in any kind of high culture as I grew up, but in low culture, in B movies, in comic books, in graphic novels, in horror fiction, and all of those things that English majors are taught not to approve of.
Well, there is another way to get your dose of the supernatural. You go to church. Isn't that where you hear about such things?
Yes, that's the other alternative. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon that people of my generation, which was really the 60s generation, began this kind of massive exodus into fantasy and sci-fi and all manner of the supernatural in their reading at the same time as they branched out into all kinds of alternative spirituality. For myself, I must say I was not into the spiritual aspects of it until I wrote a book called The Secret Life of Puppets, which was really exploring the supernatural grotesque in Western culture. And why was it that the supernatural was always monstrous and horrific? I looked at H.P. Lovecraft's horrific monsters.
And you write about how H.P. Lovecraft was always reaching for some kind of dark transcendence.
He was, and in a way, he was doing it in a very unconscious manner because he absolutely declared himself a materialist, an atheist, someone who had no truck with any religious belief whatsoever. Yet these supernatural creatures he created, the great old ones, this horrific band of monsters who are completely indifferent to mankind. So in him, there was this contradiction. And the funny thing is that now many people have taken up his works and used them as a kind of scripture to create their own spiritual practice. And
So Lovecraft has become the high priest for some people.
He has, and they acknowledge that how they explain it is that he was basically channeling transcendental truths and reality that his conscious mind was not able to accept.
The thing cannot be described. There is no language for such abysms of shrieking and immemorial lunacy. Such eldritch contradictions of all matter, force, and cosmic order. A mountain walked or stumbled. God! What wonder that across the earth a great architect went mad, and poor Wilcox raved with fear in that telepathic instant. The thing of the idols, the green, sticky spawn of the stars, had awaked to claim his own.
So if we take this story a little closer to the present, other people would seem to have followed in Lovecraft's steps. Well, you say Anne Rice and Stephen King are probably the two most famous Gothic writers of the late 20th century.
Yes, and they both were continuing this, you know, 250-year-old tradition by showing a very dark side of the Gothic Rice and her vampires and King, most, I think, memorably in his paranormal children who have these amazing powers that immediately lead them to be ostracized by their communities, and then their ensuing rage and feelings of rejection cause them to wreak havoc on the surrounding community.
After all you've been taught,
everyone in Bad Mama, everything in the sin.
Come to your closet and pray, ask to be forgiven.
He's a nice boy, Mom. You like him. You really like him, Mama.
Tell that boy you're not going or we're going to move from here.
No.
Move from here and you'll never see that boy again. The rain's coming in.
Mom, please sit and talk to me.
Let him close the window.
Mama, I'll get him. Please sit and talk to me.
I'm going, Mama. Things are going to change around here.
Now, I've always taken as my touchstone a wonderful comment by the late poet Paul Bray, who said, "The American occult is the intellectual life of the common people." Mm. And I also think the American occult is the spiritual life of the common people. People have used the Gothic as a kind of place for a lot of low-level theological rumination.
Are you saying? And, I mean, are you talking about Anne Rice's novels, for instance? Are you saying people are playing
absolutely
out their religiosity in these vampire stories?
Absolutely. When Interview with the Vampire was first published in 1976, it was a milestone in the vampire gothic subgenre for a lot of reasons, but principally because she made this radical change of putting the vampire story in the first person. And by doing that, she basically flipped the antagonist villain into the protagonist hero. You immediately empathize with someone who's telling you his story, even though it's full of violence and crime and degradation and so on. You're much more sympathetic to the vampire's point of view.
And then it would seem that Stephanie Meyer in her Twilight series has taken that even further. I mean, the vampires are very much the heroes, at least most of them, the main characters, and they're kind of like modern gods.
Oh, yes. And Rice was the one who first started this because she relabeled the evil undead the Shining Immortals. And Meyer is really kind of the culmination of this in that she takes her vampires to a level where they are really kind of supreme examples of higher human consciousness. Her vampires have superhuman powers of clairvoyance, of supernatural strength, of seeing into the future. And this is really an offshoot, a kind of extension of Mormon theology.
And of course, Stephanie Meyer is Mormon herself.
And she is Mormon, and she's usually criticized by critics as, oh, well, the abstinence theme in her books is social conservatism and so on. But I feel those people have not read the fourth novel where all the sex takes place, and they don't really see that this is the Mormon doctrine of exaltation, which is the belief in physical resurrection and assumption of the Godhead after death. That is, humans are, after death, if they've led a righteous life, are the equals of Jesus Christ. I think the interesting point is that this isn't really an arcane feature of Mormon theology as much as it is a very ancient and quite widespread strand of alternative religious thinking. The notion of being divine while you're still in your human body.
You're impossibly fast and strong. Your skin is pale white and ice cold. Your eyes change color. You never eat or drink anything. You don't go out in the sunlight. How old are you?
17.
How long have you been 17?
A while.
You know, I have to say, your cultural reading is fascinating. I mean, looking at the sort of the spiritual roots of these vampire stories, in our modern secular culture, as many people just can't accept a lot of religious orthodoxy, the thing that's left is this gothic subculture with its monsters. If we want to have some taste of the supernatural, that's where we go. At least that's where a lot of people go.
Yes, and that's, I would argue that many, many more young people in America know a lot more about Harry Potter than they do about the New Testament.
But is this a real metaphysics here? I mean, is there something serious intellectually going on if we're actually looking to Harry Potter?
Not so much Harry Potter, I would say, as some of these other works that create real alternative universes like Lord of the Rings, even Star Trek for that matter. And in terms of Twilight, there's now a very small subset fan religion called Cullenism, in which practitioners will read from the four novels at random every morning and then select from either Bella or her vampire in-laws which Cullen they choose as their personal god. That is, which traits of that character do they most admire and want to emulate?
Are that people serious about doing this?
Crashingly silly, but people want a wider range of a pantheon, if you will, than, you know, the three bright male gods of Protestant Christianity. They want women, they want monsters, they want all kinds of things. And out of these funny little cults and sects that form around these fictional works, they're creating this very interesting stew of new religious ideas.
You're really saying that you can't draw a clear line between what is literature and what is religion, that in fact they feed each other, and that perhaps religions of the future will be inspired by great books, or popular books at least.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And I would not be surprised if some other new religion on the order of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Christian Science, some new kind of coherent system developed out of all of this crazy experimentation that's going on right now.
Victoria Nelson talking with Steve Paulson. Her book is called Gothica, Vampire Heroes, Human Gods, and the New Supernatural.